All right, if you got your Bible, if you want to go ahead and turn to Genesis 37. We're beginning the longest continuous narrative in the book of Genesis. It's largely, when we talk about it as the story of Joseph. And Joseph is the main character of this story, but it's really not about Joseph in the same way that it has been about Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. It seems as if the focus really is not just on Joseph, but on the generations after Jacob. You see this right away in verse 2 of chapter 37, and where it says, "Now these are the generations of Jacob." So we're looking at his descendants. There's also this big shift, right? Before I mentioned it last week, I think, how we've continually heard the title of God as the God of Abraham, of Isaac, and Jacob. Joseph's name is not included in there. So though he is, you know, one of the patriarchs, he's not the only one. And this really is kind of a shift in the story. We've seen the Abrahamic blessing, the Abrahamic covenant that was made just with Abraham, then passes to Isaac, and then passes to Jacob. It's not going to pass just to Joseph, right? It's going to go to all of Jacob or all of Israel's sons who are going to become the 12 tribes of Israel. So it's really about them. So Joseph kind of marks the shift where God is no longer just choosing a particular person to bless, but now he's going to be blessing a particular people and how that kind of continues. If you remember our kind of the overview of Genesis is how God chooses to bless a particular people so his blessing can spread throughout the whole world, overcome the curse. So here in the story of Joseph, we see that blessing go from just being on a particular person to going to being on a particular people. And really in Joseph's story, we are seeing how that blessing is supposed to spread and how it spreads not just to all of the tribes of Israel, but to the rest of the world as well. Joseph's story, it's a really significant, it's an important story. It's one of the most well-known stories, probably, of the Bible. And really, Joseph's story foreshadows a lot of later biblical characters who are going to come. There's a lot of Moses' story that is echoed or repeats. There's parts of David's story that repeat, and significantly as well, there's parts of Jesus' story that we see glimpses of and foreshadowings and patterns that kind of repeat over and over again. And so the story of Joseph too, you know, kind of a big idea from it that's helpful for us to see is, you know, the Joseph story teaches us that if we're going to be followers of Jesus, you can't expect everything to go great. And even if you are chosen by God and he's going to use you to bless the world, you still can't expect it to go great. You might expect there to be mistreatment. You might expect things to not go your way. You might expect a lot of pain and a lot of suffering. But you can have hope and you can have faith and have encouragement that God still is in control at every step of the way. And that even those things that others mean for evil, God can use for good. And so that's kind of just a big picture overview of Joseph's story. And this, it's kind of hard to see it a little bit. I couldn't find a big enough one that this would let me put on here, but it's something from the 6th century in Egypt that's kind of a picture of Joseph's story. But so kind of getting into it right away, you know, in verse 1, we have Jacob lived in the lands of his father's sojournings in the land of Canaan. So Jacob, Israel, seems to be living still in the promised land, and it's the place where his dad used to sojourn and kind of pilgrim around. Jacob doesn't anymore. Seems to be now they're living there more permanently in the land that God has promised to them. And again, too, you know, these are the generations of Jacob. This isn't just me making this up. It seems that the focus is not just on Joseph, it's on all the sons, which is why we start here, and then 38, it seems like we take a break and we go to Judah, and we get lots of Judah and Reuben and their kind of thoughts throughout it. Because this isn't just Joseph's story, it's all of the brothers and the tribes and Jacob's descendants. And so Joseph, he's 17. It tells us his age. This will become important later. He's 17 years old. He's pasturing in the flock with his brothers, you know, and he was a boy with the sons of Bilhah and Zilpah, his other father's wives, and Joseph brings a bad report to their father. So Joseph snitches. He tattles. I've learned recently this is a big no-no in Germany. We really don't like people who do this. This is what Joseph does. His brothers are behaving in a way that is shameful, which should not be surprising to us based on what they did to the men of Shechem, based on how they're going to behave the rest of the story. and selling their brother into slavery and framing his death. They're not great guys. So it doesn't tell us what they're doing, but we can assume it's probably pretty bad. And so Joseph tells on them, and they don't like it. But they have other reasons not like him either. And three, Israel loves Joseph more than any of his other sons because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a robe of many colors. So he gives him this extravagant, beautiful robe that you normally wouldn't have a robe that has that many colors. This would have been very expensive. This would have stood out. Anytime Joseph walked around, they would have been able to see from far away, ah, there he is. And this becomes a part later in the story. When he's still far away off, they can tell that's Joseph. Look at what he's wearing. And it's also just this kind of permanent reminder that he's the favorite. He's the golden child. He's the one their dad loves the most, and their dad doesn't really care for them very much. It's hard if you have a lot of siblings, or if you have any siblings, you might have felt like maybe your parents liked one of them more than you. I mean, really hard if he's this obvious about, this one is my favorite, and I don't like you guys at all. Watched a wrestling movie a while ago about the Iron Claw, about the Von Erichs. They were really big in the 70s down in Texas, and the start of the movie is just largely pretty accurate. Their dad, gets down and says, okay, now we all know Kerry's my favorite, and then David, and he just ranks all the kids. Says, but guys, things can always change, if you impress me more. So that's basically what Jacob's doing here. He's saying, Joseph's number one, he's my favorite, he gets the coat, but you guys could stop behaving so shamefully, maybe you could move up, maybe he'll get you fancy shoes. He's not being a great parent here. And his brothers hate him so much that they cannot speak peacefully to him. They just can't be around each other anymore. Can't even be in the same room. One of them has to leave. They can't talk, they can't pretend, it's just they hate each other so much, well really they hate Joseph so much, that if they're even in the, if they have to say something, they're going to start fighting. That's where the story starts, which is not great. And then it devolves here, and Joseph has two strange dreams. Again, this is kind of the point of the story where God stops appearing physically, and now it appears he begins to appear in dreams and speaking more prophetically, at least in the book of Genesis. He'll appear later in other ways. So Joseph has a dream, and he recognizes in some way that this isn't a normal dream. This isn't just like, wow, guys, crazy thing I dreamed last night. I ask my kids what they dream, most mornings, and we talk about it. Sometimes they think they dreamed it. Sometimes we're just telling each other silly stories. This isn't like that. It seems like Joseph knows this is something significant. This is prophetic. This is from God. And so he's compelled to have to share it. It appears. So he shares the dream, which leads to, he tells it to his brothers, and they hate him even more. He doesn't have to explain it. They already are angry. Now, something that is important for us to note here, and I think it's significant, is Joseph does not interpret his dream. He tells and reports, here's what I dreamed, and then his brothers hate him. Joseph tells them what he dreamed, and he doesn't say, and here's what God told me this means. He just says, here's what I dreamed, and then his dad is angry, and his dad hates him. Now, we know the rest of the story, so it's easy for us to, we kind of know how it goes, so I think sometimes too quickly we can just skip over, this means his brothers are all going to bow down to him, and he's the one who's chosen, he's the one who's blessed. That's not what Genesis 37 tells us. It doesn't ever explicitly say anything about how we're supposed to interpret these dreams at all, actually. And I think that's on purpose. Now, here, you're going to get, this is my opinion, this is my interpretation, so you can disagree with me, and that's fine. But you have to listen to mine right now. I think that's significant for a number of reasons. And I think part of what is happening here is the Bible is trying to show us that Joseph's brothers and Joseph's dad didn't interpret these dreams correctly, and they got it wrong. I'll give you the reasons I think of that. One of which is, too, all the other dreams are interpreted and very clearly said, and this is what this means, and God has told me what this means. These two, we don't have that at all. Joseph doesn't say anything about them. He reports them, and then his brothers interpret them. And I think it's they're wrongly interpreting them. And so they believe right away, you know, I hear this dream, you know, he tells them the dream, hear the dream I have dreamed. Behold, we're binding sheaves in the field, and then mine arose and stands upright, and yours gather around it, and they bow down to mine. And his brothers said to him, you know, oh, are you indeed to reign over us, or do you intend to rule over us? They hate him even more for his dreams and his words. See, again, they interpret it. He just tells them what it means. And then the next one, he dreams another dream, and he tells it to him. Behold, I've dreamed another dream. I'm sure they weren't happy to hear that. The sun, the moon, and the 11 stars were bowing down to me. But when he tells it to his father and his brothers, they rebuke him and say, what's this that you've dreamed? Shall I or your mother or your brothers indeed come bow before you on the ground? And then they're all jealous. But the father remembers it. Again, Joseph doesn't interpret it. God doesn't interpret it. I think part of the problems with their interpretation is they believe that this means Joseph is going to be over us. Joseph is the chosen son. Joseph is the one who the blessing is going to be passed down to, which is what has happened in the previous generations, right? Abraham had Isaac, and Isaac got the blessing. Ishmael did not get the blessing, even though he was older. Jacob gets the blessing, not Esau, even though Esau is older. And part of it is in the blessing that is said, and your brothers will bow down to you. Now here they are, now we have to bow down to Joseph. Joseph is not the one who gets the blessing. Even of any of the ones who are chosen, it is Judah who gets the blessing. Because Judah is the one through whom Jesus comes from. He doesn't come from the tribe of Joseph, he comes from the tribe of Judah. That's one of the problems, I think, here. I also think that the reason this dream is given is not to show that, like, Joseph is awesome and Joseph is the one who is chosen. It is meant to prophesy and warn them and foreshadow about what is going to come. It's not a story about how they will bow down to Joseph. I think it's more about how Joseph is going to save them from what's about to come. In the first dream, again, the brothers never bow down in the first dream. They all are out in the field, and then they gather up some grain, and their grain falls over and bows down, and Joseph stands upright and straight. Part of what that is it seems that their bags, their stuff that they have is bowing down because they're empty. They don't have very much of it. It's not good. But Joseph's grain is standing up straight and good, and there's a lot of it. I think that kind of foreshadows the famine that's going to come when all their grain is going to run out and they're going to have to go down to Egypt. And Joseph has plenty of grain. The second dream, right, it only has the celestial bodies, it has the sun, the moon, and the 11 stars. It's never mentioned that this is Joseph's family. He just says, dreamed about 11 stars, dreamed about a sun, dreamed about a moon, they all bow down to me. And then his dad rebukes him, which he shouldn't be rebuking him. You can't, even if these aren't God-given dreams, we can't really control what we dream about when we lay down. You know, what is this? Shall I and your mother and your brothers have to bow down before you? Now, in all of the other dreams that we'll see later in Joseph's story, anytime numbers are a part of them, anytime numbers are mentioned, they're always interpreted first, but they're also always interpreted temporally. So when he's in jail and he dreams and the cupbearer has the dream of three branches, and then says, oh, those three branches, that's for 3 days. And the bread maker, when he has the three baskets, and he says, oh, that's 3 days. That's what that symbolizes. And then Pharaoh, when he has the dream about the seven cows, the seven bad cows and the seven good cows and the seven bad ears of grain and the seven good ones, Joseph says, oh, those are 7 years. So at least here, that would then be strange if those numbers suddenly now don't mean something temporal but mean something different. So if it is something temporal, which also makes sense because we use the sun and the moon to tell what time it is, use the stars, and then they would use them to tell, you know, what year it was and how things have passed. If you add them together, 13, that's how many years Joseph spends when he's in prison before he is made the second most powerful person in Egypt, which is also part of why do we find out that Joseph's 17 at the beginning, and then we find out how long time has passed at all of these. I think that's part of it. Or if you do, you know, if you take the sun and the moon and then you multiply it by 11, that's 22 years, and that's how long it takes before they're all reunited and Joseph reveals his identity to his brothers. I think maybe that is a little more likely. The other problem, too, if it is his brothers and his father and his mother's dead. because she died in childbirth when Benjamin was born. So if there's 11 brothers that he has at this point, he does not have his mother, and they're kind of clear in the way that they talk about it. They don't, you know, refer to their husband, you know, their dad's other wives as mom. It's their mom. Also, Jacob never bows down to Joseph in the story. There's not one time as we go through the other 14 chapters that Jacob is going to bow down. The brothers will bow down. That's going to happen. But Jacob doesn't bow down. In fact, Joseph is going to bow down to Jacob later after they're reunited. He won't bow down to them there. So I think, you know, we're not really given any reason to trust Jacob or the other brothers' interpretations of the dream, especially considering their conduct and the way that they act throughout this chapter. They're not exactly the most trustworthy people. If you're going, well, I've got a word from the Lord. I knew who I'm going to go to. I'm going to go to Reuben because he hates me, and he's also slept with my father's wives. That sounds like a good person to find out what God thinks. I don't think so. Now, again, I could be wrong here. I'm not the only one who's come up with this. I've found some other scholars who were kind of pointing some of this out and leading this way. I think it makes more sense that this isn't showing that Joseph is going to be over his brothers, but is trying to warn ahead of time, here's what's coming, and Joseph is going to be the one who's going to save them from famine. And there's some other things that will come up later. But so that's that. Moving on in the story, we have in 12. Now his brothers went to pasture their father's flock near Shechem. That's the place. Last time they were there, they were slaughtering innocent people. So that's not good. That should already kind of prime us for, something not great is going to happen here. And then Israel sends Joseph, hey, aren't your brothers at the flock at Shechem? Here, I'm going to send you to them. Should already prick our ears. Hey, yeah, that place where your brothers killed a bunch of people and your brothers who hate you? Yeah, why don't you go there by yourself? And Joseph says, okay, here I am. He says, yeah, go see if it's well with your brothers and with the flock and bring me word. And he really there doesn't say well. He uses the word shalom twice. He says, I want you to go and say peace to them and see if they have peace. Meanwhile, we've already heard that they cannot speak peace to him at all. So this is bad parenting. Just from the beginning, what he's doing is we should... You know, we already know the story, but we can see, this is not going to go well. These brothers who don't like each other, who can't speak peace, going to a place where innocent people have already died. Now Joseph's going there to try and speak peace. It's not going to go well, and it doesn't. And Joseph has a random encounter, which is kind of weird. Wonder why this is happening, because he's on the way, and he gets some directions. And the man finds him wandering the fields, and he asks him, what are you seeking? He said, well, I'm seeking my brothers. Tell me where they are. He says, they went somewhere else. They went to Dothan. And so Joseph goes to his brothers and finds them there. I think that's probably there on purpose. I don't think it's just there to let us know, like, Joseph got confused and wanted to figure out where his brothers were, so they went somewhere else. I don't fully know why this is in here, but I have a strong conviction and belief that everything in the Bible is there on purpose. We don't find out every time somebody needed to get directions to go somewhere, and I'm sure this isn't the only time that ever happened in the book of Genesis. So I think the question that the person asks him is significant. You know, this, what are you seeking? Where do you think this is going to go? What are you looking for in life? I don't know. That's my thinking out loud. But so then in 18, they see him from afar, of his coat, and then before he comes near, they conspire to kill him. As soon as they see him, they decide that they're going to have to get rid of him, and they say, let's kill him, let's throw him in one of these pits, we'll say a fierce animal's devoured him, and then we'll see what becomes of his dreams. They are going to see what becomes of his dreams, and what they're going to see is that they can't stop him, no matter what they do. It's the amazing thing about God and his sovereignty and his power. He can tell you what he's going to do, and then people can try to stop him, and then he's going to do it anyway. He's going to use what you tried to stop him to bring it about. Satan, all his demons, couldn't stop Jesus. Might have thought they won when they killed him, but they didn't. They played right into his hands. So they can't stop them. So they have this murder attempt. And then Reuben and Judah kind of have an opposite plan. So Reuben says to him, "Now let's not shed any blood. Let's throw him into this pit here, but let's not hurt him or not lay a hand on him. Let's not beat him. Let's not kill him." And he said this that he might rescue him out of their hand to restore him to his father. So Reuben is kind of like, "Oh, no, this is wrong. We shouldn't do this." But he's not righteous or bold enough to say we shouldn't do this. He's just like, "Let's just dump him in here, and then I'll get him out later." So he's not trying. He's kind of trying to direct the riot instead of doing anything. But none of the brothers listen to him. They don't. Well, I mean, they kind of listen. They throw him in a pit, but they like Judah's plan better later on, which should give us somewhat of an insight of how the brothers also feel about Reuben, the oldest, if they don't always do what he wants to do. But so they do throw him in the pit at first, and it tells us the pit was empty and there's no water in it, and then they sit down to eat. You know, I think that detail is important. Joseph is now in a place where he has no food and he has no water, but his brothers have plenty of food and have plenty of water, and they're sitting down to eat and have a nice meal. Well, Joseph suffers. And if they don't intervene, he'll starve. Way later in the story, Joseph is going to have plenty to eat, and Joseph will have plenty to drink, and if he doesn't help his brothers out, they will starve. So this is kind of, it's setting up for the reversal, and kind of the irony that's going to happen later. So then, they sit down, and then when they happen to look up, a caravan of Ishmaelites coming from Gilead, and their camels bearing gum, balm, and myrrh, on their way, carry it down to Egypt. And then Judah has his idea, says, "Well, what profit is it if we kill our brother and conceal his blood? Let's sell him and not let our own hand be upon him, for he is our brother, our flesh. But we shouldn't kill him. That's wrong. But, you know, we can sell him and make some money off of him, and then we don't have to deal with him anymore." It's kind of the weird moral logic that Judah is doing here. Well, that's not as sinful. That's better. I'm not sure that it's better. Well, it's definitely not righteous or good. But so they sell him, and they just so happen to sell him to the sons of Ishmael and the descendants of Abraham's other son, who was not chosen by God to carry on the blessing. I don't think that's random. So they pass by, and they take Joseph, and they lift him out of the pit, and they sell him for 20 shekels of silver, and they sell Joseph to Egypt. It's foreshadowing Judas and how he will betray Jesus for money as well. These things. Well, what profit is I just betray Jesus? I need to get paid too. They don't risk it. So it's kind of setting up that narrative there. And then Reuben comes back to the pit. So Reuben seems to be gone. And while he's gone, Judah latches his plan instead. And he tears his clothes, returns his brother, and says, "Oh, the boy is gone. Where shall I go?" So then they take Joseph's robe, they slaughter a goat, and they dip the robe in the blood. That word used for dip there, it's only used in about one other place, particularly with blood in the Old Testament, and it's in Exodus 12, when it's describing Passover. After they take the innocent Passover lamb, they are to take, hyssop and dip some of it in the lamb's blood and then paint their doors. So, again, some of this is foreshadowing and showing Joseph's innocence and this goat's innocence. But so they do that, and they take the robe of many colors, and they bring it to their father and say, "This is what we found. Please identify whether it's your son's robe or not." You notice they don't lie. They just present something without interpretation, and then Jacob interprets it, and he interprets it wrongly and doesn't understand what's actually happening. I think that's also on purpose. I think that if he can't interpret that correctly, I'm not really going to trust him to interpret the dreams correctly either. And so he says, "Oh, it's my son's robe. A fierce animal has devoured him. Joseph is, without doubt," no doubt, knows 100%, he's torn to pieces. Well, his interpretation's wrong here. But I think he's interpreting that wrongly. But so then Jacob, he tears his garments. He puts on sackcloth on his loins, and he mourns for his son for many days. There's so many things that are set up in Genesis that really, if you start to understand Genesis, you can really understand a lot of the Old Testament later, because this is the normal pattern that we will then see over and over and over. And you see in the New Testament as well. You see Jesus do this at points. When people are mourning or they're lamenting, they do what Jacob did here. They tear their clothes. They rip them. They put on sackcloth. They put on something that's, not good clothes, but shows they're in mourning, and then they mourn for a long time. They refuse to be comforted, and they mourn for many days. So that becomes kind of the regular pattern later for Israel. Whenever they have times, especially of national mourning, it's tear your clothes, put on the sackcloth, and then for days, for weeks, we're all going to mourn and we're gonna cry. So that's kind of the regular pattern that happens there. So they, all his sons and his daughters, they rise up, they try to comfort him, but he refuses to be comforted and says, "No, I shall go down to Sheol to my son mourning." Thus his father wept for him. Meanwhile, the Midianites had sold him to Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, the captain of the guard. Just so happens that Joseph does make it down to Egypt safely. They don't sell him off somewhere else. He doesn't die in the journey, and he ends up right where God wants him to be to set up the rest of the story. So what do we, some application, what are we supposed to do with this? Well, if you're mad at somebody, don't throw them in a pit and don't sell them in slavery. That's bad, just in case that needed to be said. But I have a couple of applications, and I ended up just finding all, there's plenty of verses to back these up, but I just picked them all from 1 Peter. 1 Peter has a lot to do with suffering. But like Joseph, as believers, we are commanded to be a blessing to the world. This is part of the Abrahamic covenant and the Abrahamic blessing. It was not meant to be just, I'm going to bless you and no one else and hold on to as much of the blessing yourself as you can. Don't let anyone else get it because they're dirty pagans. This is just for you. No, the blessing was always meant to spread throughout the rest of the world. It was always meant to spread to others. It was always meant to spread out the blessing and to be a blessing so that they would want to come and worship Jesus and come and worship God. So as Christians, we still have that same mandate. We are commanded to go and to be a blessing to others and to the world and to those who are around us. Also put them all in 1 Peter so I didn't have to flip around too much and Bree got mad at me for not putting them in the bulletin in my notes. But here, I mean, this is a good one. In 3:9, it also ties in well with what Joseph will end up do. Don't repay evil for evil or reviling for reviling, but on the contrary, bless. For this is what you were called, that you may obtain a blessing. We were called to be a blessing to others. And so even when we are mistreated, even when we are reviled, even when we are cursed, just like Joseph is, the way we are supposed to respond is with blessing. Because God is choosing a particular people to spread his blessing throughout the world. And if you're a member of the church, you are the particular people God has chosen to spread his blessing. We also know that like Joseph, Christians will be misunderstood. Joseph was misunderstood by his brothers. They didn't get, even if you think I'm wrong, kind of how I'm interpreting the dreams, it seems very clear that they're going to bow down to Joseph because he's going to save them. He is the one who's going to deliver them. But they didn't get it. They were focused on the wrong thing, focused on them being the ones who were important, not that Joseph was going to help them in their greatest time of need. There also will be times that those who follow Jesus are not going to, the world won't understand, won't get what you're doing, won't get what we're doing. Why do you believe the things that we believe? Why do we act the way that we act? 1 Peter 4:12, beloved, don't be surprised at the fiery trial when it comes upon you to test you as though something strange were happening. That's one of my favorite verses in there. I mean, I don't like it, but it's also funny. Don't be surprised, okay, when you're misunderstood, you're mistreated, when being a Christian isn't the most popular thing and people don't slap you on the back and tell you, wow, how amazing, that's so awesome that you're a follower of Jesus. Jesus never told us to expect that or to complain when we didn't get it. He said, yeah, that's normal. Don't be surprised when you face that. Also, like Joseph, Joseph was mistreated. Joseph had to suffer. If you're a follower of Jesus, you may also have to suffer. That is and should be our kind of normal expectation. Now, I don't think this means that we need to have a persecution complex and just always interpret, you know, every time somebody's being mean to us, think that we're being persecuted, or, you know, go out and chase martyrdom or anything like that. But it does mean that our expectation of following Jesus shouldn't be that I'm going to follow Jesus, I'm going to be obedient, and then everything in my life is going to be good and smooth, and I'll be blessed at every step. And that's normal. And if I'm like experiencing suffering, or my kids aren't acting the way that I thought that they would, or the people that I love are dying, or man, my life is filled with lots of suffering, what's wrong? Oh, nothing's wrong. That's actually the normal expectation for what the Christian life should be like. And if you have something different than that, you're experiencing the abnormality. I think most of what we see in the Bible is that following Jesus is filled with suffering. That's normal. And that's a blessing. 1 Peter 5:10, after you've suffered for a little while, the God of all grace, who has called you into his eternal glory in Christ, will himself restore, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. Now the promise is the suffering isn't eternal, it ends. And the promise is that one day Jesus will restore, he will confirm, he will strengthen, and one day there will be no more suffering anymore. But we shouldn't be shocked when it happens. And most of the time what we see in the Bible, it says we should actually rejoice and we should celebrate when it happens. I'll stop before I preach a whole other sermon on that. But I think that's part of what we're going to see kind of again and again in Joseph's story, is that he is kind of a prototype of what the Christian life is going to look like. Now, anything I can clarify? Any questions? Yes. Possibly. There are some minority scholars that can't outright say that because we don't know what's going on in Jacob's mind. But there were some who said, it kind of seems like I think he is punishing him. But, you know, they said it very skeptically, hedging their bets. So he definitely could have been. It seems really dumb. So it's either like he's just getting old and he's not with it anymore and he forgot what's been happening, or maybe he's punishing him. I don't know. Good question. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. No, that is a whole nother thing. No, but that's a very important thing. And it's important and it's very significant that we say God, in the typical language that we use kind of universally, Christians of every tribe will say God is not the author of sin. God did not create it. Now, he allowed it. He did create a world in which it could come forth. And then the problem is, well, why? Because we wish he wouldn't have. And that we don't, I mean, we have answers, but we don't have the most satisfactory that answer all of our questions. But the beautiful thing, and what we see, especially in Joseph's story, and we see again in Romans 8:28, is that God does take sin and he turns it to a good purpose. And he can take the worst that life or the enemy or even ourselves can do, and he can work it out for our good. We cannot mess up God's plan. And it is meant to be comforting. That's not meant to like make us feel like we don't have any choice. It's to make us feel like, oh, even when I destroy everything, God can still put it back together. Kylie, were you raising your hand? Or?
In our family, we kind of have a comment that Genesis 15:20 principle, when bad things happen to
it does. That's the Romans 8:28 is one that I cling to in those. And it can be tempting to try and identify the good when you're in the midst of it, to say like, oh, this is why God's making this bad thing happen. Usually not as much for ourselves when other people are suffering. That's like, oh, well, I'm sorry. But hey, here's, you know, God could use that to be a good testimony, or, you know, whatever other things that we say. But we don't always get to see the good. It's going to take Joseph 22 years before he figures out why God was doing what he was doing and why God allowed it to work out the way that he did. It's going to take us a long time, too, to see why God allowed some of the things that he allows. But one day at the end, we get to stand before him. Then we're going to get all the answers. And then we'll see it in its fullness. And it's going to be okay. Might not be okay yet, but it will be one day. Let me pray for us. Lord, I praise you and I thank you that you work all things, not just some things, not just big things, that you work everything for the smallest among us, for our good, for those who love you. Lord, that there is no suffering that we have faced that you cannot redeem. There is nothing the locust has stolen that you cannot restore. There is nothing death has taken from us that you cannot bring back. We thank you and we praise you that you are the God who can turn evil to good and works all things for the good for those who love you. Would you help us to love you? Would you help us to trust you, especially when we're down in the pit and we don't know what comes around the corner? Help us to hold firm and to hold fast to our faith in you and in your goodness. And we pray this in your holy and precious name. Amen. All right. Thanks for being here tonight.